Welcome back, everyone, to the fourth episode of the Film Fund Podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Verity, founder and executive producer at the Film Fund. We are an online film funding platform that serves as an alternative to things like screenwriting contests, crowdfunding campaigns, grant applications, things that take days and days and tons of money to submit to. I wanted to create something a little bit more simple. You write one sentence pitching your short film for a chance to receive up to $10,000 and other prizes as well, such as Adobe Creative Cloud subscriptions, Kitsplit equipment gift cards, in-kind post-production services, color grading, things like that. Anything that will help you make your film. We currently are holding a contest right now with a deadline coming up in just a few days on December 8th, 2020. If you're listening at a later date, we do hold contests all the time, so be sure to go to thefilmfund.co to find the most up-to-date information on our deadlines. Today we have Avi Settin, super interesting person. I don't even know what to call him. Filmmaker, artist, visionary, just has such an interesting and creative background. And he's also a judge on the Film Fund, so we'll be able to get some insight into what our judges look for in pitches. Avi, thanks so much for coming. You can give a much better bio than I can.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and thanks for doing this. Don't know that I can give a much better bio. I don't know how to label myself either. My life and career has been all over the place, so I hope that it can be of interest to some people. But most certainly my focus has been in the film world for most of my life.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, we have your background on the Film Fund website too. If people want to check out that, you go to thefilmfund.co/judges. One thing I do want to ask you about is, what got you into filmmaking? I mean, I remember a conversation I had with you years ago where you said there was a period of time where you watched two movies a night just all through, I think it was high school or something like that. Was that kind of the inception of your film journey?
Yes. Watching movies was my real journey. I did go to film school, but it was like too little too late because I had already just devoured as many films as I possibly could. And it started for me in the year 2000. I was 14 at the time. AFI, American Film Institute, released the top 100, or their version of the top 100 American films of all time. The library near me had like a section that was devoted to that list, and they had probably like 80 to 90 of the 100 films.
Oh wow!
So I spent that summer with my mom, who was a huge influence, essentially watching, you know, like 80 to 90% of what were considered by a pretty prestigious source as the greatest American films of all time. So by the time I was like 14, I had already seen the American film canon. Mm-hmm. And then like from then through the rest of high school was when I really started watching two movies a day, and they were foreign, and I started going back to different decades. And that was when I really expanded my film knowledge outside of American films.
So you weren't making anything at this point yet. It was completely studying, really.
I was making, you know, I remember my first personal camera was a VHS-C camcorder, and I made like little movies. My brother is a filmmaker. He's 7 years older than me, and he was a huge influence. So I was always doing things with him and with my friends, like little, you know, just little fun movie projects. The other, I guess, pretty big influential moment in my childhood was also around the time I was 14. I went to New York Film Academy at Princeton. I was actually very lucky because I had a friend who was, it's basically a family friend who was a teacher there. And he basically got me to study a really, he got me in there for free. And it's an incredibly expensive program that I would never have been able to afford at the time. Mm. All I had to do was pay for the film stock. So when I was 14, I was also exposed to shooting on 16mm film, editing on a Steenbeck, kind of the last hurrah of, I feel like, I don't know if you ever had that opportunity, but I feel like that's, I think that's the difference in our age gap. Like I was just able to have the opportunity to work with 60mm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I also haven't gone to film school, so I know sometimes that's something they make you do as an exercise, right?
When I went to film school, you know, 4 or 5 years later at NYU, using actual film stock and editing on a Steam Deck was all completely optional.
Oh, well, gotcha. Yeah, so if I don't go out of my way to... My film school journey is still up in the air. I may go get my MFA one day, but still TBD as I'm working on the film fund. But doesn't sound like that'll be like a necessary rite of passage I'll have to go through.
No one's going to make you shoot on film or edit by hand. It's just not a thing anymore.
I might want to do it anyway, though. It looks so cool. And you get... I mean, I guess it's kind of the same thing with like vinyl records. You're actually touching the medium in a way and cutting it together, which is so cool.
Absolutely.
I mean, those are definitely some, the word formative is popping into my head, but I don't really know where I'm going with it. Anyway, in terms of, studying and just immersing yourself in film, do you think that had an influence on your wanting to teach screenwriting? I know we've talked about you, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, SOCAPA or SOCAPA?
It's called, the School of Cinema and Performing Arts. Okay. SOCAPA. It's like, it's in like 6 or 7 cities. I think it's like a year round thing, but it was the first job I had in LA when I moved out there after college. I was only really involved with like the summer programs, which was pretty much, it was like a summer camp for high schoolers.
Okay.
To learn filmmaking, screenwriting, acting, dancing. It was all kinds of, different types of arts. Mm. And I was primarily responsible for working with the film and screenwriting people.
How did you get involved in that?
The family friend I told you about who got me into New York Film Academy when I was 14, was the director of the LA chapter of SOCAPA. So arguably knowing that I had that job was probably what helped me even consider moving to LA. Mm-hmm. Was because I knew I had work when I got there. And I really just started as like a sort of counselor assistant. And eventually they gave me the responsibility to start teaching. My mom's a professor, so it's always like maybe been in my blood, so to speak, mm-hmm. but it's never anything I sought out to do or expected to do.
Mm-hmm. What were some of your experiences like there? Did you enjoy working with high school students? It's pretty young age level in terms of film.
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's a hard question to answer because it's like, from a personal experience, I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. This was after college and was seeing a totally different, you know, not that much younger than me, but like a kind of new generation and how they were embracing TV and film. And it was just interesting to see all the different attitudes. I think that's what really struck me, is like you had people there who you knew film was their like embodiment of everything they wanted to do. And then mm-hmm. there were people who were just there for fun and curiosity. And being someone who tried to like appeal to all those types of personalities and at the same time usher everyone a little bit in the direction of the power of the medium, mm-hmm. of the moving image, is something that was super fulfilling for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put you on the spot. Avi asked me before we started rolling what kind of things I would ask about, and I left out one thing because I think this is just going to be pretty fun. And if you get mad at me, Avi, don't blame me. Blame the producer, Tom, because this is his idea. Super simple. I'm going to put 30 seconds on the clock, and I want you to give us a 30-second screenwriting course for aspiring screenwriters or for maybe more experienced screenwriters. Any, just your screenwriting course in 30 seconds, and I'm going to start in 3, 2, 2.5. I don't have my timer ready yet.
I don't like your producer, Tom.
One, go.
God, that's really difficult.
20 seconds.
Either write to sell or write for personal fulfillment. It's really, really hard to find in between. Can I curse?
Yeah, go for it.
But it's really fucking hard to find that in between. if you can find it, then run with it for as long as you can. But realize, was that it?
That was it. But just finish it.
Realize there are two schools, and they're getting more and more and more pronounced. And one of them is selling; it's money based, and the other is passion based.
I like that a lot. That echoes something one of our previous guests, Chris Mendoza, said. He is an executive producer here in Philly for a production company, and he does right now mostly corporate work, but he also has an arm of the company that does narrative work too. We had a conversation about producing work for, I forget the exact, I think for the soul and for the bank account is what it was. So that's kind of
exactly
those two worlds you're talking about as well. And I like that you approached the screenwriting course in 30 seconds that's kind of a producing mindset too. It wasn't, oh, we'll find your character and do this and do that. It was more practical, which I liked.
Yeah, if you don't think like a producer at any point, if you're a screenwriter, you're going to run into a lot of trouble. So I think first and foremost is you have to like ground yourself in reality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause if no one wants to watch what you're writing, then you're writing for yourself.
Yeah. Which is hard because a lot of writers get into writing for personal reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with, you know, a market economy. Mm.
Speaking of the market economy, let's talk about a massive company called Google. that is just such a
nice segue.
What did you say?
Nice segue.
Oh, thank you. I've been doing this, what is this, the fourth episode? So this is my fourth time now. How did you get that job? What was it like to work for them? Some of your best experiences?
Those are all different questions. How I started working there, it's like kind of a long story, actually. So the real abridged version is I was teaching at Lehigh, where you and I met. Mm-hmm. And while I was teaching there, I had a friend who was leading. So Google was starting a VR team, or they had started it a couple years earlier. And my friend was beginning the New York chapter of that team. So he was leading a team of like 40 or so designers, engineers, et cetera, in VR in New York for Google for the first time in New York. Anyway, he realized that there were times where he just needed someone to sort of film stuff. That's really how it started, was I came in whenever he called me just to film random things. Mm-hmm. They kind of just needed a resident filmmaker, and I sort of just filled that void pretty quickly. Anyway, long story short is that once in a while gig thing turned into a 2-day-a-week contract, which turned into a 3-day-a-week contract, which turned into a 5-day-a-week still contractor, but enough that it was that I had to like leave Lehigh.
So they liked what you were producing for them, essentially.
Yes. And then eventually turned into a full-time job, and the job transformed. And actually I ended up starting a company there at the end of my career there. So yeah, my time there was all over the place.
Yeah. That's what I'm super interested in. And I have a very, very tiny insight into what it was like for you working there, because we worked together on that one project. I was a freelance producer there for, I guess, like a, you know, very small contract. Well, not small, it's short, like 1 week or so. But your role transformed from, I guess your first title you said was filmmaker, and then you became founder in residence. So is that the right title?
Yeah, kind of. I had like three titles. Yeah, my technical title was founder in residence at the end.
Okay.
But by the way, you did a great job.
Oh, thank
that
you.
Week, and it was really great working with you and having you on board.
You as well. I love that experience.
Yeah, it was.
I don't know how much we can talk about it given the NDA they had me sign, but
I think at this point, It's like,
oh, has it expired?
It's expired. Yeah, I closed down the company, so I think okay, we're fine now.
Cool. We can talk about that if we want. But I'm more interested in the transition, how your role transformed from filmmaker to that founder role. And what did that role entail? You said you were creating companies within Google. That's such a crazy thing for someone on the outside of Google to think like, oh, creating companies within Google. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think first it's really important to understand who I was coming into it. And you know a little bit about me personally. At the time I was at Lehigh, what I was all about was like, I was at the point of my life where I still haven't made a feature film. And I was like, all I want to do is make a feature film. So I basically got my own equipment, saved up, and like start like super, I mean, it was like Black Magic. It was like, you know, nothing too fancy, but enough that like I could try to pull off my own feature. And I literally just learned everything myself, lighting and sound, and was kind of the mentality that like I could be a one man like team to try to make a film. So I was going into Google with a suitcase full of equipment and just like making videos that I think they thought were going to be scrappy and making them look really professional by myself. And so that was huge because I really created my own role as I went along. Like I was at Google technically as my first role was mixed reality filmmaker. And I was there for doing that. If you include like the time where I was contracted, it was like a 3-year period and it evolved very slowly. So resident filmmaker isn't really appropriate. That's how it started. By the end of that time, I was shooting 360 videos. I was traveling all over the place, making VR content. I was filming mixed reality content, which meant like if somebody wanted to visit Google or YouTube and see what a VR experience was like from the outside, I was the person responsible for giving them the view of the person in VR so that they could see what that experience was like from a third party perspective. So I was doing I was essentially creating my own job there and was lucky to have the freedom to do that because it was such a young, new, unexplored team. So fast forward to the truth is actually Daydream, the VR team at Google, was starting to dwindle. I don't even know if they're an official team anymore because just funding in VR shifted a lot there. So I started looking at other opportunities. And one of them that seemed up my alley, because I had no reason working at Google. Like I have no tech experience. So if I wanted to stay there, I had to sort of find a role that made sense for me. So they have an internal incubator. A lot of large companies do this. Google's is called Area 120. The name comes from the concept. I can't say practice, but the concept that Googlers are supposed to be able to spend 20% of their time working on whatever they want. That's one of like Google's operating philosophies, like 80% working on your job, 20% doing what you want. It doesn't actually play out that way. That's the idea.
Sure.
So Area 120 was supposed to be this internal incubator where you could spend 100% of your time working on that 20% project.
I see. I don't think I ever asked where that name 120 came from. So that's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I pitched them a project and it was accepted. And then I became technically a founder in residence, but also a product manager and CEO of a small internal startup.
What was that like? I mean, transitioning from mixed reality filmmaker to now you're suddenly founder, CEO, project manager of a company inside Google. Did you have any kind of imposter syndrome or anything like that?
Absolutely, as a manager, but from the perspective of what we were doing, from the very beginning of my time working in VR, I had always said, and I still believe profoundly, VR is way too big of a step for the average consumer. Video is film/video is only like 130 years old. we barely know how to interact with it. Mm-hmm. So the company that I started was an interactive video mm-hmm. company. And
that's the product I was involved with.
Yes. And we've seen snippets of it, like Netflix has released some interactive stuff, but it's more like choose your own adventure. The way that I was looking at it is just, I really think there is so much unexplored potential with interactivity. And I think it's this huge gap that is preventing VR from taking off, is that consumers are missing this entire spectrum mm-hmm. of how to interact with video.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the project we worked on, yeah. I thought it was so cool. I mean, my role was so varied. One day, I remember I was camera opping, and it was great because when you're camera opping, obviously you're looking at the viewfinder, and so I was really keyed into the show we were producing, and it was this interactive live sketch comedy thing. I guess you said the NDA is fine, so I can mention the organization we were with at the time, right?
UCB.
Yeah, we were with UCB. Which we had some UCB guys on the last show, actually, Don Finelli and friends. Whenever I say Don Finelli and friends, it makes me think of a morning talk show. But anyway, it was so cool because we were watching this live sketch comedy and there were these like interactive messages popping up and the audience kind of controlled what was going on through their phones. And it was such a cool and new medium to see. With COVID, I'm not sure how much of that is being worked on or what the direction is, but that project was just so cutting edge to me, and it was so cool to blend filmmaking and tech. And we didn't even, speaking from a producing perspective, I remember I was in charge of ordering some equipment, and you were like, yeah, just get the most inexpensive stuff you can find. I was so surprised. I was like, this is Google, and you're telling me to get a $20 Amazon tripod. But in retrospect, I was like, well, that's exactly what I would have done too. Like, we didn't need anything more than that. We were shooting on iPhones. It was proof of concept. And it was just so cool. It was like, integrating low budget filmmaking, but at Google, and making it this cool cutting edge tech. It was just such an interesting experience. It was so cool to see, like, there was almost this, you said the end product wasn't scrappy, but I think the approach to it was definitely, maybe scrappy is the wrong word, maybe like resource conscious.
I would say, I think there's a few ways to respond to that. Well, first of all, like,
that wasn't even a question. I was just rambling. But yeah. Definitely answer. Well, it.
there's a few things that made me think of, and first and foremost, I'm glad that you enjoyed the experience. Cause it really was like a pleasure having you and that small, like, tight knit team working together. It was a lot of fun. Secondly, I can tell you, others have actually run with the concept. Somebody recently sent me I think it's one or two of the guys from the improv show Whose Line Is It Anyway.
No way.
They're literally doing exactly what we did.
Oh wow.
Doing, live comedy shows where you can interact with your phone. So the concept is well and mm-hmm. and alive. And I enjoyed it. It wasn't ultimately what I had set out to do with the company on like a high level, but it was really special and important to see it working in some capacity. And then the other thing just to address about resourcefulness is it's twofold. One is, yes, we were operating under Google, but we were also like very encouraged to treat ourselves as a startup. And I think that's the point of the internal incubator, is like Google can really like blow through money. Sure. If you're YouTube or a bigger org inside of them, the whole idea of having these internal startups is to work with limited cash mm-hmm. flow. And I was an inexperienced manager. That was probably part of it. And the last, the last part of it is, we were shooting on phones. Yeah. Like it's a new way to experience content. We weren't looking at, you know, at like a movie theater screen or a 4K TV. This was content meant to be viewed on a phone, mm-hmm. Which really changes the way that you embrace filming it.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
I mean, it was cool. It was, you know, it's like, oh no, the, this shot's overblown, like it's overexposed, what do I do? And then you just, oh, just tap here and it'll readjust. It's just, it's like, oh, well, that's pretty easy. It was cool. And that's really, I think it was such an, even though it was under that corporate umbrella of Google, it was really an encapsulation of what indie film and indie producing means to me. It was making something really unique with just completely limited resources and equipment, which was just so cool. So talking about indie film and film producing and film funding, let's go back to the film fund. As a judge, I mean, what have some of your favorite winning pitches been? Or, you know, if you can't think of any off the top of your head, what have some of the things that have stood out to you in those pitches been?
Oh, there's so many good, there's been so many good ones.
I know, it's, the judging is so hard, seeing all of these pitches come in.
It is. I feel like the lists have been getting longer. Is it just me?
Yeah, we are growing, which is great, which is, it's also difficult because we do have our judging criteria, you know, right? One sentence, less than 200 characters, or no longer than 200 characters, I should say, and it has to have a compelling premise and a creative use of funding. And the best pitches relate that funding use to the compelling premise. But it is difficult, and we have been, it's difficult because we get so many great pitches. You know, they're,
yeah,
it's cool to see these amazing concepts pitched in one sentence, like an elevator pitch. But we have been expanding a little bit, yeah, and that's why you'll see the finalists coming out now as opposed to just the list of winners, because we're, and more prizes as well. We're doing Kitsplit gift cards, we're doing Adobe subscriptions, we're doing in-kind sponsorships for post-production services, things like that. Yeah, we are growing a little bit.
Yeah, because I feel like even at the beginning, I used to spend hours going through all of them, and yeah, now it's just like, holy there's nothing, to be honest, there are a lot that come to mind, but it'd be unfair to like be like, oh, there's one or two that really stood out over the others, because there really have been dozens, if not hundreds, of really great ones. My biggest qualm is if people who are participating in Film Fund are listening to this, there are so many that are such great ideas, but just don't follow your very simple formatting, which is to just make it one sentence.
Yes.
And I would just say and urge people to just follow
that direction. That's a big thing.
And spelling and grammar.
Yes. That's a huge thing. I mean, spelling and grammar, we are definitely so important. It's one sentence. So make sure that's, you know, what's the expression? Up to snuff? Is that a word?
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
We do give a little leeway with that. Like Don Finelli's winning sentence had a dollar sign. So things like that, you know, we're fine with for saving space. But write one sentence. That's one of the things we look at, because it sounds stupid on the surface. It's like, oh, you wrote more than one sentence. But I mean, it's attention to detail. Producing a film is all about having a high attention to detail. So definitely follow the instructions. Because there are some pitches that come in that don't follow the instructions sometimes, and it's sad we have to disqualify them.
Yeah, and furthermore, there's just so many submissions that and a lot of great ones that it'll often come down to like these tiny little choices that make one over the
other. It's stressful, like going through these and selecting my choices. It's crossing them out. It's like, oh, it pains me. But that's part of the game.
It's been a pleasure, and I'm glad that you, and honored that you brought me on board.
Oh, thank you. I mean, we've been, you've been here from the beginning, definitely a mentor to me at Lehigh. I never was in one of your classes. I think I was just, it was like a professor recommended. I talked to a friend who recommended I talked to you. It was a weird way I got in touch with you. I remember we met at Saxby's, and I was like, I'm trying to produce this film. What do I do? And then I started the film fund. I was like, now I'm doing this. Can you volunteer? And it was so awesome. You were so open to doing that to someone you barely knew. So we've definitely been super, super excited to have you on board as well. We got a little bit into this in the 30-second screenwriting course, but what's some advice you would give to filmmakers in general, even outside of pitching to the film fund? Could be a production tip, story tip, really anything.
Yeah, I think I hesitate because I feel like I'm out of the loop. Like, you know, 7-8 years ago, I was living in LA and I was working in the industry, and I probably would have had a lot more poignant advice. I feel like I am writing full time right now, and I am working on screenplays. So I feel like I guess I'm still working the industry in that way, but I think like ultimately I'd have to preface any advice I give with just how much has changed over the past decade, especially with distribution. You know, when I wanted to be a filmmaker, it was like, it was, I see the Clerks poster behind you. And it was like that time, it was the 90s. It was like, you know, Kevin Smith and Tarantino and PTA and all, you know, all these like indie filmmakers popping up out of nowhere. And was like, oh, this is, you can really make a career out of this. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's not possible anymore. It's just changed drastically. Most streaming companies, and I can talk about this, like after I started working at Google, I had a really long ongoing conversation with a lot of the folks at the Netflix Interactive team, because I was kind of thinking that would be my logical next step, would be to try to work in interactivity. And Netflix is one of the only companies doing it. Mm-hmm. And they were very clear to me that, I think it's okay to say this. They were very open about like, they will not touch interactive content unless it is, what's the word? Like a big franchise. Mm.
Like Black Mirror, kind of.
Yeah. And I know like interactive content is that, you know, that's pretty specific. But I think that kind of holds true for a lot of the content you're seeing today, is like, whether or not it's a franchise, it's very rare to see voices coming from out of nowhere, mm-hmm. the way that they did in the 90s in American film. However, the big thing, so I guess my advice in that sense, if you want to work in the industry, it's kind of like, it's more about networking and connections and climbing up a ladder. If you want to try to hold on to that indie spirit in today's world, my advice is use your phone, go on YouTube, you know, really embrace the way video content is being consumed today.
Like, you could create a video podcast with a company called The Film Fund and post it on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're doing exactly the right thing, I think, for the situation that you're in.
Yeah, it is crazy to see how indie film has changed. I mean, there is that bit of an age gap between us, but I mean, even just the past few years looking at indie film and how it's changed, like, you see this streaming is such a new phenomenon, really. I mean, 10 years ago, like, I don't know the exact dates of when Netflix shifted from DVDs to streaming, but it wasn't it was 20 years ago or something like that. It's like pretty new, which is crazy to see how ubiquitous it is. You know, every gaming platform has a Netflix app, every phone. It's really crazy to see that shift. But yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think just going out and making a film today, I think it can still happen, but I think it's more difficult. I think you still need to put in, you always need to put in that networking work, which will pay off.
Yeah, and I think like in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, the film festival circuit was a much, much more reliable or viable path toward having a successful career in filmmaking. And I'm not saying that you can't make a film, enter into Sundance, and it'll get attention, and probably, if it's good, get sold and bought by a streaming service. It's just not the same.
Yeah. I think what I'm hearing is you're saying have multiple stakes in the fire. Don't just make a film. Make a film and maybe talk about it on YouTube. Make a film and send it to everyone you know and try to get meetings. You know, it's, I think, just focusing on the indie spirit. I think you need to be a little bit more entrepreneurial than that today is what I'm hearing.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good way to.
So you said you're writing full time now. What is this feature script you're working on? Can you talk about it? Because I've read a few of your features, but I don't know if it's related to that or if it's completely different.
I'm working on a bunch of stuff right now.
Well, let's hear about it. Plug some stuff if you're comfortable with it.
All right. Yeah, the one that's most furthest along. My friends will be happy that I'm plugging this. I'm writing an animated short. I'm writing the pilot episode of what would hopefully become an animation project. Its working title is called Team Bitcoin.
Okay.
And it's about a guy who is trying to start an esports company called Team Bitcoin. And it's actually very much based on one of the four writers. I'm writing it with three other people. Mm-hmm. Their names are Drew, Dylan, and Jason, all super talented people. So the four of us have been working on it, and we actually right after this, I have a meeting with an animator for the first time. So we're just starting to bring it to life. We finished the script and pretty excited about it. It's fun. It's like super silly, very, very like timely and relevant, and very much based on my friend Drew's life, who the way that I describe him is as the person who I know that is most living in the center of the future. And
that is quite a description.
Yeah. And the irony behind it is that he's doing it alone in the middle of nowhere in a giant cabin. And so I just find that.
So he's writing in a cabin right now?
Living
in a cabin.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know what I said.
I don't know what I heard. So he's living in this cabin alone in the woods, but he's at the center of technology in the future.
Yeah, I just think at the center of the modern world, like he's been like a huge cryptocurrency supporter like years before it became mainstream. Mm-hmm. He's very, he tried starting a political party. He tried starting a religion.
This guy sounds very interesting.
He is just one of the most interesting human beings you've ever met. And it's loosely biographical about him. Mm. Obviously it's made animated, so it's a little bit sillier. And it's a pleasure having him on board as one of the four writers to literally help shape.
How did you guys all get connected?
Jason, I worked with at Google. We all went to the same high school, so that's the real answer. Mm-hmm. But we've all like been friends and worked together in some capacity. But mainly Jason is the strongest connection I've had. We worked together at Google, and Drew has been a friend since high school, and so he's always just been connected to us. And then Dylan and I wrote, I think the most recent script I sent you, it was called American Strangers. Mm-hmm. Was one of the first times I ever actually tried writing with someone else, and it was Dylan. Mm-hmm. And it was a fun script to write, but I think ultimately it was the discovery of a really, really nice collaborator. Mm-hmm. So
you're not going to pursue Dylan, American Strangers at this time?
No, not making it, at least. I would love to have it made one day, but so I'll segue to the second project I'm working on, which is with Dylan, just the two of us, and it's a reaction to American Strangers, and we've decided to try to write something as opposed to like more of a passion project, which American Strangers was. We are intentionally trying to manufacture the most sellable product. Mm-hmm. We can. I mean, just to be completely honest about it.
For the bank account writing, as we call it.
Yeah, and to see if we can pull it off and mm-hmm. like treat it as a puzzle. And like what keeps me going is like, hey, if we can pull this off afterwards, we can do whatever we want. Mm-hmm. The third main one I'm working on is a modern adaptation of Robin Hood.
Okay.
Which is a series we're also working on the pilot episode.
Not and I'm Men in Tights.
No, no, it's like very much taking place in today's world. Mm-hmm. Like wealth gap of today mm-hmm. is really what it's about. And yeah, I don't know. And yeah, that's basically it. And I'm writing that with my brother, Ishai, who's a filmmaker who lives in LA, and Dylan, my collaborator, is also writing that with us. So those are like the three main projects. I'm also working on stuff on my own, but mm-hmm. I'm not going to plug that stuff.
Okay. You can if you want to. I mean, we have a colossal listener base here that tunes in every week. It is growing. We just started. So, I mean, speaking about writing with other people, I mean, four people, that's got to be, I mean, I know I've seen Academy Award winning scripts by writing teams like that, but I guess during the pandemic, what have some challenges been working with a team of that size?
We all have totally different sensibilities, and mm-hmm. that's what makes it work. And it was really hard to find that dynamic. So originally, this animated project, three of us tried writing it, Drew, Dylan, and myself. And it just kind of fell apart. And I don't think it like speaks to us, but I think it was like, it's really hard to write during the pandemic and have three voices working together. I think adding Jason into the mix was a really great idea because he's not a writer. He's like definitely, he reminds me more of like your mentality. He's like, he's a producer. Not that you're not a writer, but I think you would consider yourself a producer first, right?
I would at this stage of my career. Yeah. I mean, I am writing and I have a script kind of on hiatus because of COVID, but I would consider myself a producer first.
But I guess maybe the better way to phrase it is like, if you're working on something on your own, you're constantly juggling the producer mentality and the writer mentality. Yes. So like having someone who's 95% producer and then having someone who's 95% writer and then having someone who just needs to like recount funny stories from their past. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that we all just are friends and have like a good working dynamic, it works. I think if we were too similar, it would not mm-hmm. work. But the fact that we're all super different people and add completely different components, it's working way better than I would have expected.
Technologically speaking, how does it work? Do you guys all share, are you using like Celtics or Celtics, or is it Google Docs?
In terms of the, I mean, we for meetings, obviously, like we use like Zoom or Hangouts or whatever, but only two of us are actually, like Dylan and I are the only ones who have real screenwriting experience. So we're the only ones okay. who have final draft. So in terms of the script, we work on it in Google Docs and then Dylan or I will transfer it into final draft when we get to that point. But I would actually say the more insightful lesson I've learned in collaborating is the tool that has been by far the most useful for us is using Google Slides and just having a slide deck. Because having a doc can get really chunky. People just keep adding stuff. Having slides, being able to add images, reorganizing it any way you want, has really been, I think, a key tool for us to collaborate and stay on the same page.
Do you think you would have done that regardless of the pandemic?
Done what?
Use slide decks.
I don't know. That's a great question. I have no idea what effect the pandemic has played on my work habit.
I guess when you say slide decks, because when I think of a deck for a film, it's usually like a pitch, right? But it seems like you're talking about it in terms of more of story, right? Like more story beats.
It's kind of like, yeah, if you're collaborating with someone and you have a doc that you're sharing, or even if you're using Celtics or Final Draft and you're in collaborative mode, you can run into like issues of communication. Maybe a better way to put that is there's a lot of communication, visual communication, like images and mood boards and just like ordering. I guess like visuals is just the key. It's like sometimes we want to like talk about them. We just want like a picture to be associated with what we're talking about. And like, you can't do that efficiently.
I mean, I guess it makes sense too, because it's a visual medium. So like getting that writer's mental image externalized. So it's like a series of ongoing mood boards and things like that. Yes. Okay, cool. That's a super interesting approach to writing. I mean, I was wondering if it was more like the index card method you'll read about in, you know, like Sid Field and things like that. But it seems like it's more visual.
I think it's because it's four of us. Mm-hmm. And so if we like talk about a character, we want to make sure all four of us are on the same page.
I see.
I think if it was just me or, you know, I don't make slide decks for my own projects. So I think it's, that's really what's at the heart of it, is trying to collaborate with a bunch of people. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Is there anything else? I mean, you said you didn't want to plug your own projects, but anything else big in the future you'd like to talk about?
I have like three features that I'm like slowly hacking away at on my own. The one that I am excited about, that I hope I finish like in the next few months. I've been working on it forever.
You were writing a novel too, not to be that guy. Where's the novel?
Yeah, novels. Like... the real quick like explanation there is, when I left Google, I was like, I want a about face, abrupt turn, get as far away from the future of technology as possible, and go back to like the roots of storytelling and expression and art. And I was like, fuck it, I'm moving to the suburbs and I'm gonna spend a year writing a novel. And I gave it a go for like 6 months, and I wrote part of a novel, and I was just like, I don't really have that much experience writing prose. I wasn't too proud of it. It was like, you know, I have 15 years of screenwriting experience. I think I'm just more comfortable writing in that medium. So at some point I just kind of like, you know, like face the music and was like, let me just do what I think I'm good at.
I mean, it, based on what I know about you, it seems like your whole life has been immersed in film and video and interactive types of mediums. So I could see why trying to write something in prose would be not exactly where you would vibe. Speaking about your whole life, I guess being intertwined is not the right word, but in film, one of the craziest things I know about you is that you were in the original Wet Hot American Summer, right? tell us a little bit about that, how you got involved. And
I just did like a video for them. You know a bunch of movies did like script readings. I know Princess Bride did one. They did like basically for Biden for president a couple months ago in support. So David Wayne actually like contacted me and was like, hey, can you record your line? So I have one line in it, but I just recorded it, and I guess I got a bunch of texts from like,
that's so funny,
who are fans who saw it.
What's the line?
See
it.
See if I can remember it.
Oh no, I think I'm gonna sneeze. Has anyone sneezed on a podcast before? Oh no, I think we're good. We're good.
I'll tell you the line, but I'm not gonna do the voice.
Okay.
The line is, white folks sound so stupid when they get mad. They'd be like, hey asshole, I'm going to kick your behind. But the brothers, they don't even need to raise their voice. These motherfuckers be like, don't make me say it twice. And it's, you know, I'm this scrawny little white kid trying to be like Eddie Murphy. That was the idea. Like,
I got it.
So that was fun. And the story behind that is, I was an actor when I was a kid. And that's it. I did a bunch of theater. And at one point, as I was falling in love with movies, it took me a little bit of time to realize actors weren't the sort of brains behind everything. That was my shift toward writing and directing. Mm-hmm. But when I was super young, I just thought actors did everything. So I wanted to be an actor. And eventually convinced my parents to let me audition for a manager. I got represented, went to a bunch of auditions. Had a few roles in like small things, and my one line in Wet Hot American Summer will haunt me forever because it became a cult classic. And it's great. I love the movie. So I couldn't be happier to have been a part of it. It's just really random.
Yeah,
part of my
that's great. Past. That's why I, speaking of our producer, Tom, again, if you have any other funny stories together, this is the last time to share. And I just think that's so funny because knowing how intellectual you are, and your experience in both the corporate and the film world, it's like, oh, he was also in Wet Hot American Summer, which is just, it's just like this throwaway. It's so funny. Avi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning. A ton of great insights from producing to writing to acting as well, I guess. We just want to plug the current contest again. We currently have three contests. We launched a new music video contest, so we fund short narrative films, short documentary films, and music videos now. You can win up to $10,000. For your short film or music video just by writing one sentence, and make sure it is one sentence, not two sentences, as Avi liked to remind us. In addition to the 10 grand, we also have prizes such as Kitsplit equipment gift cards, Expressway Cinema rentals, Adobe Creative Cloud subscriptions, and more, and some post-production services from Maestro Filmworks. There's a ton of new prizes. You know, we are getting more submissions, like Avi said, so we want to be able to award more filmmakers. And remember that that deadline is in just a few days from now, December 8th, 2020. But if you are listening at a later date, go to thefilmfund.co or thefilmfund.co/contest to get the most up-to-date information. You could also check out our blog at thefilmfund.co/blog. Great name. It's great filmmaking and producing tips, so check that out as well. Sign up for the newsletter and follow us on social media to stay up to date. Next week, I believe we have Matthew Greenberg, who is one of our earlier filmmakers who won the Film Fund. I think he's the second ever winning filmmaker. So going back a couple of years, super excited to talk to him. Avi, anything else you want to add?
No, just thanks for having me. And I think it's really awesome you're doing this. I'm stoked for you to keep pursuing your dreams. I hope this keeps working out well.
Awesome, Avi. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon for the judging.
See you, Tom.
Peace.